whatever the hell it is, we'll have to run with this because it's 12:35 and that'll only give me like 10 minutes to get my ass out of this chair for In the Spirit of Things. But anyway, back to the Bowels Report, Endless Bad News and Horror, every Tuesday at noon, 104.1 FM at BerkeleyLiberationRadio.info as soon as we get that fixed.
Hey,
and yay! Or stream it or tune in radio. Right.
Or the Russia bad, the bad Russia story.
Yeah, their war on capitalism included freeing our property. Bad DJ. Okay, so now, did you know I found a Russian under my bed this morning? God damn it, they're everywhere! This one says Tolstoy, so I just popped it open here. It says, I cannot be silent. Well, probably that's my case. You know how obsession and compulsive is.
Tolstoy was a kulak.
7 death sentences. 2 in Petersburg, 1 in Moscow, 2 in Penza, and 2 in Riga. 4 executions, 2 in Kherson, 1 in Vilna, 1 in Odessa. This repeated daily in every newspaper and continued not for weeks, not for months, not for a year, but for years. And this in Russia, that Russia where the people regard every criminal as a man to be pitied and where, till quite recently, capital punishment was not recognized by law. I remember how proud I used to be of that when talking to Western Europeans. But now, for a second and even a third year, we have executions, 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 unceasingly. I take up today's paper. Today, May 9th, the paper contains these few words. Today in Kherson, on the Strebetsky Field, 20 pheasants were hung for an attack made with intent to rob on a landed proprietor's estate in the Elisabetgrad district, E-L-I-S-A-B-E-T-G-R-A-D, Elisabetgrad district. 12 of those by whose labor we live, the very men whom we have depraved and are still depraving by every means in our power, from the poison of vodka to the terrible falsehood of a creed we impose on them with all our might, but do not ourselves believe in. 12 of these men strangled with cords by those whom they feed and clothe and house and who have depraved and still continue to deprave them. 12 husbands, fathers, and sons from among those upon whose kindness, industry, and simplicity alone rest the whole of Russian life are seized, imprisoned, and shackled. There! You need any more proof? Bad Russians under every bed, and that was under my bed tonight, this morning, or whatever.
Now, when that's Tolstoy.
I don't believe he was born.
Soviets fell because even though we were using the World War II loot to take them down, they were being propped up by the Rothschild money. And Adelson got his $25 billion, you know, making oil refineries in the Soviet Union. So if they're taking money from these people, they're not arresting them. And right there, you can't be a communist if you don't arrest the Rothschilds, okay? They armed both sides in all these wars. Moses Bauer was the royal banker of Hesse, and he used his puppet Napoleon to shake down his boss, so to speak, the prince, and really off with their heads. But that's the rotten thing in Denmark there, that genocide loot from Turtle Island, that ton of gold was used to buy up the British consuls. And when the Rothschild puppet Napoleon lost, he used Judendeutsch to cross the line so nobody could read it, unless you're going to pretend to rape Moses, and that's just such a disgusting thing. Most people know better, but there are the 1 in 10 who sell out the rest, you know, for possessions, because they have no security in... Well, now there were pharaohs like King Tut, and let me include them in my little pinballing around the universe here, because you can see the hieroglyphics, the ka visiting the mummy. And just like the first, thou shalt take no life, in Egyptian, in African tradition, it's an affirmation. I have taken no life, right? So even if you are...
This is dedicated to anybody in the audience who is engaged in a similar profession as to the gentleman who's mentioned in the song here.
One, two, three.
dedicated to you if you're a dope smuggler. Know that. Every year along about this time it all goes dry. Nothing around for love or money that'll get you high. Henry got pissed off and said he'd run to Mexico. See if he could come back holding 20 keys of gold. Now the road to Acapulco is very hard indeed. And it isn't any better if you haven't any weed. Henry's driving hard and straight on twisty mountain roads. There's 50 people waiting back at home for Henry's load. And now he's rolling down the mountain, going fast, fast, fast. And if he blows, this one's gonna be his last. From the Acapulco to turn the golden key. Henry, keep your brakes on for this corner if you please. Well, Henry got to Mexico and turned his truck around, talking with the man who has it growing from the ground. Henry tasted, he got wasted, couldn't even see. And how he's gonna drive like that is not too clear to me. And yet he's rolling down the mountain, going fast, fast, fast. And if he blows it, this one's gonna be his last. Run to Acapulco to turn the golden key. Henry, keep your mind on your driving if you please. Well, Sunday afternoon, Tijuana is a lovely town. Bullfight brings the tourists and their money flowing down. The border guards are much too busy, there at 5 o'clock. Henry's chucking right on through, hardly even stops. And now he's rolling down the mountain, going fast, fast, fast. And if he blows it, this one's gonna be his last. From Acapulco, turn the golden key. Henry, keep your mind on your driving if you please. Oh, yes, he's rolling down the mountain, going fast, fast, fast. And if he blows it, this one's gonna be his last. Run to Acapulco to turn the golden key. Henry, keep your brakes on for this corner if you please.
Maybe you and me. Welcome back to the People Speak with...
Okay, let me explain all that. I forget what I was thinking about when I played Henry, but that's my religion, just to keep that clear. And then there was Victor Jara, because we've got to say rest in peace to Lynn Stewart, NATO target lawyer, and a good riddance to the Rockefeller gang that murdered Victor Jara. And...
Abre sendas por los cerros, deja su huella en el viento, el águila le da el vuelo, y lo cobija el silencio. Nunca se quejó del frío, nunca se quejó del sueño, el pobre siente su paso y lo
lo sigue como ciego. Córrele, córrele, córrela, por aquí, por allí, por allá. Córrele, córrele, córrela, córrele que te van a matar. Córrele, córrele, córrela, córrele que te van a matar. Córrele, córrele, córrela. Cabeza es rematada por cuervos con garra de oro, como lo ha crucificado la furia del poderoso. Hijo de la rebeldía, lo siguen 20 más 20, porque regala su vida. Ellos le quieren dar muerte. Córrele, córrele, córrela, por aquí, por allí, por allá. Córrele, córrele, córrela, córrele que te van a matar. Córrele, córrele, córrela, córrele que te van a matar. Córrele, córrele, córrela.
Publications and movies, everything else, to so-called win a battle for ideas with the Soviets, and ended up in the process adopting some of their more nefarious means. But when you say the CIA tricked the world's best writers, you're talking about a pretty sharp group of people like Plimpton and Styron and all that. Were they really tricked?
Yeah, well, that's a great first question. I did an event in Berkeley last week, and actually had a Paris Review magazine veteran come by and ask me essentially that same question. And his reservation was the word "finks" and the word "tricked." More "finks," though, which he thought was derogatory, as someone who had been at the Paris Review.
Now, I would guess Larry Bensky would say that, but that's just me.
View, he, you know, he may have felt that there was some, whether well-intentioned or misinformed, idea of patriotism. And Finks, of course, as you know, when you finish the book, comes from one of my characters. Tricked was the word I settled on, how the CIA tricked the world's best writers. It could have been paid. It could have been subsidized. It could have been used. It could have been collaborated with. And I actually envisioned at one point, I couldn't sell this to my editor, a cover where in sort of lighter shadow behind the word tricked would be all those other words going up and down the front of the book. Yeah, I think a lot of the writers had different motives, and actually some of them throughout the book you'll see, you remember, they changed their minds. So some of them were more in favor in the early 50s by the time the Vietnam War hits and the CIA's reputation is a little more tarnished. Some of them were less in thrall with the agency and other kinds of anti-communist institutions. So yeah, it might have been any other verb there besides trick.
What I found, and knowing some of these people, they're a pretty sharp bunch. I mean, this really goes to, I think, more David Halberstam's idea in The Best and the Brightest, with his classic work on what happened in Vietnam, that these were the best products of the meritocracy. This was the creme de la creme of Harvard and Yale and the Yale Review and all that sort of thing, the brightest minds, the most talented people, and for whatever reason, sometimes for greed, but also, you know, they bought into it. What they bought into was basically a stupefyingly simplistic and wrong-headed notion of what was going on in the world. And that's the overwhelming thought I came away with from your book, which is great in detail, great storytelling, you know, whether it's about Pasternak or whether it's about Sontag or anybody. I mean, they're all in there. There's a lot of really rich detail. But
thank
the
you.
Overwhelming sense that I got from this book was how, once again, using Halberstam's idea of the best and the brightest, how did this group of people who certainly were literate and well-traveled and tested well and got great grades at the best schools and studied under the best people get it so wrong?
Yeah, I think that the idea of the oversimplification that you described in your question, I think that's accurate. And I think the sharper ones were more removed from that simplification. And then what you see are several groups in the anti-communist movements, several actual organizations that were sort of recruiting people, that were representing the CIA's slush funds, who are luring people in who have standing internationally, people who can do some soft power work, but might, if they know exactly what's going on, they might be a little too critical of it. So if you start, for instance, in Berlin after World War II, you have a group of people who were familiar with Stalinist methods to the degree that perhaps they were traumatized by them. So those people were sincere, but they weren't necessarily nuanced in their understanding of how to maybe fight totalitarianism. They thought essentially that the best method was to fight fire with fire. So in a way, these were guys who had a conspiracy theory. Their conspiracy theory went like this. Soviet Russia is penetrating organizations around the world. They had some evidence, Comintern and other organizations, but they had no sense of scale, and I think by the time you have McCarthy discredited in the middle 50s, some of these guys were probably willing to dial back some of their initial fears, but by then they'd set this great movement in motion where it was just huge amounts of money that the CIA could offer. And so what I look at, as you remember in the book, is just I look at these little intellectual magazines that were initially recruited to do two things. One, to push back against anti-Americanism. So they wanted to tout and brag about our high culture, because in Western Europe, which was the key battleground, we were known for our pop and low culture. We were known for Marshall funds. We were known for our tanks. So one can sort of appreciate that, but then it comes with another idea, which is to discredit the Soviet Union as often as can be. And when you see that, how it plays out, you start to see disinformation beginning to spread. And what you see presiding over both sides of that idea is a regime of secrecy, which is problematic when you're talking about magazines, because you're talking about secrecy being used to preside over and rule over the free press that we're supposed to be the champions of.
The reason your book is compelling, and I think people should read it, and let me just be clear right up front, I read it mm-hmm. straight through. I think I had one breakfast break, but I enjoyed it enormously because it really
you.
Makes these characters come alive. And they're not cardboard characters, whether you're talking about Irving Kristol or you're talking about, you know, Irving Howe or, you know, George Plimpton or anybody. There's a whole bunches of them run through the book, and you really are introduced to the cultural life of Paris and London and New York and so forth. But again, I keep getting back to this one question. You know, there's a thing in newspaper business, I remember one editor telling me, too good to check. And maybe when somebody's writing you an actual check and you're getting money and you're getting first class airfare and they're funding your wonderful magazine, your little magazine, and so you don't right. have to go to your parents, because most of these people were super rich and they could just go to their uncle or father or something and get some more money. But still, it was now, you know, classy to get it from some secret Fleischmann yeast or someplace
right.
that was a front
right.
for the CIA, you know. And so, yeah, you're involved in intrigue and all that, which I guess a lot of writers like to be involved in. But the idea that they drank the Kool-Aid
right.
and thought they were saving freedom is the part that I still don't get.
It does seem like there was a big pivot after World War II, and I think one of the organizations that normalized the idea of secrecy ruling over the media, which is eventually what you end up with in a program like this, was the OSS. A lot of the people, the founding lights of the CIA, came to see that the OSS had done some great work in, as they saw it, thwarting the Nazis during World War II. So a lot of the people who founded the CIA, they understood that if the Soviet communists were using secrecy to penetrate our organizations, instead of thinking of how do we stop the penetration, it seems like it turned into a system of let's preemptively penetrate our own organizations just to make sure we can watch them and keep them on the up and up. And of course, one of the ways that they keep people in line, as you say, was through the money. So in terms of the official magazines that the CIA created and presided over, the British spy who overthrew Mossadegh, he would have been in June of 1953. His name was Christopher Montague Woodhouse. He would have been working on the CIA magazine for London, Encounter. He would have empowered the two editors, one American, one Brit, Stephen Spender on the British side, Irving Kristol on the American side, both working out of London, one paid through secrecy of the British state, one paid indirectly through the CIA. This spy overseeing this, Woodhouse, he would have then turned in the late summer towards overthrowing the democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. And then later, he's also feeling so good about this system of what essentially you have are coups as covert ops and then long-term soft power propaganda, also on the covert ops side of the CIA and British Secret Services. So he feels so good about this that he's later on a contributor to Encounter. So magazines like Encounter, they were created in Paris, they were created in Italy, they were created all over Europe, and then they spread to the Nordic countries, they spread to the Third World. What they did was they involved people at different levels. So the people in the know would be people who were editors and regular contributors, and it would even for them be kind of an open secret. So one person I interviewed was a guy named Nelson Aldrich, and he collaborated first, he worked for, I should say, first with the Paris Review. The Paris Review was not one of those magazines created by the CIA, or if it was, it was sort of indirectly used. It was used as Peter Matheson, the writer, who was one of its founders, as his cover in Paris in the early 50s. But then he says he resigned from the CIA and there was no connection. Well, later on, George Plimpton, the famous writer and man about New York, who was the public face of the Paris Review through its formative years and for many decades, he found a way to get CIA money through the Congress for Cultural Freedom, its cultural propaganda front. So that's a second tie. Later on in my research, I found a third tie through a founding managing editor. So you have such a vast network of money for culture that in one organization, one magazine that's sort of only a tangential CIA asset or friend, you can find three big separate ties.
I'm glad I got this chance to talk to you because the book reads the way you talk. It's not vindictive. It's not smearing people. It's not doing what they did, actually. Right. What these folks did in the name of anti-communism was they perfectly happy, thrilled to sail out and destroy their buddies, their college classmates, to smear them, smear intellectuals that they respected. That's really what happened. You know, you're using your power, your clout. And there's an analogy right now, I think, with this whole discussion of fake news. These people were actually doing fake news. They were being paid by a government agency, the CIA, cooperating, following instructions, and sometimes censoring articles, editing them, and so forth. So they're part of an official government propaganda regime that continues quite right up through Vietnam and everything else. And so they become a caricature of the whole, you know, democratic experiment, which is certainly not what the founders had in mind, and they get very vindictive towards people who disagree with the narrative. And the reason I began the way I did asking you, the irony here is the people who objected to their official narrative turned out to be quite early on right. So, for example, you mentioned Nelson Aldrich, and you have him placed as one of those people who knew what was going on and at the parties. Well, I knew Nelson Aldrich as a guy I would chat with at Elaine's in New York for years. And by that point of the 60s, he knew it was all bogus. He was not a supporter of the Vietnam War. And in fact, he wrote a very good book about the elite and how out of touch they are, the economic elite and so forth. And I found him quite supportive of Ramparts, you know. I couldn't get any money from him from his wealthy relatives, but nonetheless, he seemed like a...
Got to try.
And you mentioned another person, you know, you one point where I don't know, if I was a little unhappy with, you mentioned Francis Fitzgerald, the famous writer of Fire on the Lake and Wild Blue Yonder, great journalist, and her father was a well-known, you know, deputy head of the whole CIA, Desmond Fitzgerald. But the fact is, Frances Fitzgerald also, she studied with Zbigniew Brzezinski, she'd gone to the best Ivy League schools, but the fact is, very early on, she embraced an opposite view. She saw that the Vietnam War was bogus. It was a fiction, and the claims made were wrong, and she wrote a devastating book on it very early on. So it just seemed to me, the crowd you're describing, I'm not going to minimize the damage they did, because they they stifled debate. They prevented a good discussion from taking place that would have avoided Vietnam. Okay? It would have avoided the confrontation with Cuba. You know, it would have avoided the overthrow of Mossadegh, you know, and we can go down the whole list. So I'm not minimizing the destructive, you know, impact that they had, and the stupefying, really, the ignorance of the debate. And I'll just give two examples of that, you know, but I want to get back to how quickly some people at least escaped this net, including, say, William Styron and others. But two villains that really emerged in their world were Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre. And and it's interesting because both of those people, particularly Bertrand Russell, had impeccable anti-communist credentials. Bertrand Russell, you know, had famously attacked communism as an evil and anti-intellectual and stifling of thought, and certainly Sartre had shown a considerable independence.
And of course, Sartre's No Exit has the leftist revolutionary hero going to hell with his right-wing torturer.
But yet, because they teamed up to do something called the Vietnam War Crimes Commission, and they challenged America in a very fundamental way on what it was doing, not only in Vietnam, elsewhere, the same crowd, and to the ones that were still influential, went out to destroy Sartre and Russell. So what I want to get across is it's not minor what they did. Your book exposes the fundamental distortion of American politics during the post-Cold War period, which is where all this stupidity came from. My only question, and it makes for a great read and it really reveals a lot, I look at the current situation where we don't even have a good communist enemy, because the communists that are in power, the ones we're trading with in Vietnam or China now. So we're inventing Russia as a reborn communist power enemy. And we have this whole campaign now as if, you know, now Putin is the evil empire. And so there is a current echo in sort of how easy it is to manipulate people.
Yeah. Well, just on the first point you made about the meanness or the lack of meanness in the book, that was something I wanted to be very conscientious about when I went through edits with my editor. There's a great scholar and writer at UC Berkeley who said something that I saw quoted recently: be tough on the institutions and be soft on the people. And that was reinforced again and again when I saw some of the collaborators with these cultural fronts of the CIA changing their minds, learning from things like Vietnam. And seeing them change their minds actually gave me a lot of hope, because, you know, you can be on the payroll, you can be someone who's an operator, you can be someone who thinks of the world as a good side and a bad side, and therefore whatever we do represents the good side. And then you can wake up from that. You mentioned Sartre. He was absolutely attacked by one of the CIA's magazines, and his magazine was seen as a threat, and the French magazine, Proof, based out of Paris, was in some ways an answer to Sartre's magazine and his attempts to deal, you know, to treat the United States the way it should be treated when it was going against its values. He would call them out on that. Neruda, Pablo Neruda, the poet, was another one who suffered severe reputational damage by this cultural front of the CIA, the Congress for Cultural Freedom, when they found out, some of these operators found out that he was up for the Nobel in 63. They wrote a quiet sort of secret white paper about him, and they made some links to Stalinism through his Stalin Prize, and it was, of course, the year that Stalin had died that he took it. And they also made up some stuff that I think was, you know, viciously untrue, that he was in on the attempt to murder Trotsky. So this is reputational damage that then is doubled later by CIA's actual overthrow of his friend in Chile, Salvador Allende. So what I see is, if someone's being physically harmed by the CIA, that's one thing that we've accounted for in a lot of historical books and political books. If someone's being reputationally damaged by CIA propaganda, you see that in some of the academic books that look at the so-called cultural Cold War. But I wanted to remove the wall between those two areas and show that both of those things happened in a context where a lot of people were just made terrified by the fact that you had evil on one side and a fighting fire with fire mentality on so-called, quote-unquote, our side.
The book is called Finks, How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers. So, and I have to take a short bias because I was the editor of Ramparts and I was involved in some of this stuff, and that's James Jesus Angleton.
Yeah.
And I am the proud possessor of a record in which J. Edgar Hoover, at one point, after all the Ramparts stuff, exonerated me and said he's going to close the Scheer case. I was the last, well, not the last, but I was the editor of Ramparts at a critical moment. And he had investigated me at the behest of the CIA and largely James Jesus Angleton. And he said, there's no there there. This guy likes to have a good time. He wants to meet women. He wants to have a good meal. You know, but the fact is, we've been investigating him for, I don't know what it was, 5 years around the clock. And there's no there there. Okay. And James Jesus Angleton and others in the CIA denounced him and said, you can't do this, you know, and so forth. It wasn't just, I wasn't the...
Oh, boy, so Angleton and Hunt were being outed by the CIA, supposedly as Soviet moles, after JFK, Oliver Stone's film, because they were scrambling, how are we going to cover our asses? And so there's this reporter who saw this CIA document. Now, he was subpoenaed, but he wasn't going to lift a finger for the Nazi paper that had said that, I think Victor Marchitti might have wrote it in the Spotlight, and why a Jewish lawyer would defend a Nazi paper is pretty complex, but there's Mark Lane, and plausible denial is that story. And the at the same time, Hunt is saying to the judge, I've been defamed, my kids are asking me, did you kill JFK? At the same time, he's using his children as an alibi. And so it has its lighter moments. But one of them is the reporter who wouldn't lift a finger for a Nazi, just like I busted my hand over that shit. He's not going to stick his neck out and lie. So when the lawyer for Hunt said, oh, you didn't really see any such thing, he's not going to lie. He said, oh, well, in fact, I did. And it did say, the CIA is going to say that Hunt and Angleton were working for the Soviets when they were involved. Because these gusanos were so stupid, they had to write H. Hunt W. House, so that even the military press Woodward had to call the White House or Bernstein or whoever and say, is Mr. Hunt there? Okay, so the Watergate burglars had White House in their pockets for the police to overlook, but not the reporters that have to, the story goes right to the 63 coup. So if you get rid of Nixon, you can say, okay, it's all over. And then you can talk about the deep state didn't like Nixon for this or that. No, they got busted. It's in circus to set the record straight. June 23rd, 1972. involves Hunt. If you open that scab, you know, make the CIA and the FBI look bad, it'll blow the bag pigs thing. In the ends of power, Haldeman explained that means the Kennedy assassination. So everybody knows it would have exposed Nixon's guilt. Along with LBJ and Poppy Bush, the triple vice was three vice presidents at the Murchison Ranch the day before our brains land on the back of the car, and then a half a century later, Big Brother is telling us that the First Lady recovered them from the back of the vehicle after driving the Patsy. They are shoving down our throats if everybody's stupid enough to have them spit in your face like that, but actually, it's America spitting in the face of the world, because then he would have stopped the Israeli nukes. He would have stopped the Vietnam War. He would have stopped the Central Reserve by issuing Executive Order 1111-0, and everything that went along with that. But
the only one that they wanted to go after. But, you know, these guys were playing hardball. And they wouldn't mind when you travel to another country, because I found myself, you know, getting harassed in different countries. I was in jail briefly in Mexico, and I was in jail briefly in Lithuania, you know, and other places, Algeria and so forth. I didn't want to get paranoid about it. But they had a reach worldwide where they could make your life really rough, or end it for that matter. So what about James Jesus Angleton? What have you learned about this guy?
Well, he was part of this post-OSS group that understood how important spying and covert ops had been in World War II. And from there, he makes all kinds of terrible mistakes. He and his group believed essentially that they needed to do better propaganda than the Soviets did, and one of the ways that they thought they could do it better was to do it subtly, and you can say secretly. So when this program is threatened with exposure in 64, 65, 66, and 67 through various sources like Ramparts and the New York Times, this privilege of secrecy that they enjoyed was not something that they were willing to give up. So you have something that is described as relatively benign, this funding of culture through the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the funding of student movements through the National Student Association, the funding of labor unions that would be less communist influenced than the communist dominated ones that they presumed were out there. These were seen as benign answers. They were reactions to Soviet penetration. And so secrecy is a key to making them work. So even if you want to make the argument that, for instance, the Congress for Cultural Freedom never censored its magazines, which I think has been severely disproved, they did censor, even if you wanted to say that they published all sorts of great writers, which clearly they did, that was part of the subtlety of it and part of the brilliance of it, and part of the soft power charm of it. Even if you want to say all that, when the secrecy is exposed by honest accounting in the media, the Fourth Estate, the adversarial media of, you know, American bragging around the world, they are so attached to their secrecy and so upset, the CIA group led by people like Angleton, that they commit something that is about as anti-American as anything in our system, which is more secrecy, more media penetration, to the point of penetrating first the anti-Vietnam War press, second the college student newspapers and press, the alternative so-called press, which essentially is a license to do what they did later. So that first thing I describe, where Ramparts was penetrated, leads to Operation Chaos, presumably. That leads to Operation Mockingbird in the 70s. By the time we have Carl Bernstein reporting on Operation Mockingbird and John Crudson reporting on its international equivalent in the New York Times, Bernstein and Rolling Stone, you essentially see the CIA trying to have at least one agent at every major news and media organization it can do in the world. And Crudson, reporting in the Times at the end of 1977, essentially says that they had one agent or contract agent at a newspaper in every world capital on Earth. That's astonishing. They could get stories killed or get stories to run that portrayed the CIA's views in a favorable way, or kill them if they did not.
point
and
out,
so yeah, Angleton is behind a lot of this, just to sort of circle back to your question, but go ahead.
No, well, but I want to get there's an interesting contradiction here, because this is not benign. What happens is you create an atmosphere in which, and you can have it in a contemporary moment, oh, let's get rid of Assad in Syria, for example. That sounds like a good liberal thing to do. And yes, there are great human rights violations by this dictator. Yes, he kills innocent people. Yeah, you know, so did Stalin. Yes, so did Khrushchev. Okay, we get that. And then the argument of that there's this war going on
between the media that call somebody that got 70% of the election and the most recent, and 55% before the Arab Sting, you goddamn gringos, the gringos waged in the Contra War that brought me down from the mountains with that. Never mind.
Part of the way they decide if an election is fair.
Between obvious good and obvious evil, and any discussion about any gray area is some kind of moral equivalency. It means you're insensitive. It means you're saying the same. And the irony here is that an Angleton was a product of an elite education. Actually was half Mexican, so maybe that gave him a burden in those circles. But the fact is, you know, he could drink cocktails with the best of them. And what came out of this was an arrogance that because you were on the side of the angels, the best and the brightest of Halberstam, it was okay. Robert McNamara, famously, you know, one of the Ford company geniuses and so forth, it was okay to kill 3.5 million Indochinese, including, and then in addition to almost 59,000 Americans, because you had figured this out. You know, and you knew who the good guys and bad guys. Now, looking back on it, it's just, of course, absurd, that you're in this country that had no way of inflicting damage on us and had 1,000 years of hostility towards China and had no real interest in Russia, and it didn't fit the model at all. And, you know, in terms of the specific incidents that you have a chapter on, this Michigan State project where, you know, Stanley Scheinbaum, whom you describe as a whistleblower, which he was, I wrote about that before there was a Ramparts. I wrote about it in a report to the Robert Hutchins Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. Henry Luce was on the board. It was very respectable, but because Stanley Scheinbaum, one of the few individuals that I interviewed to do that story, he had seen the horror of it, and he was willing to speak out. None of the others were. By the time I got to Stanley, I had gone through almost every professor, everyone had worked for either the CIA that I knew about, or I worked on this Michigan State project, which was foul from the beginning. You take a guy, Nodin Diem, who didn't even share the religion of 90% of the people there. You find him in a Catholic monastery in New York, and you decide he's going to be the George Washington of Vietnam, and you get in this crazy intervention, right? And then 10 years after that, you do that, prevent the Geneva Accords and everything in the early 60s. The only reason I knew about that story, I went to the stacks at Berkeley. I want to know what's this place Vietnam about. And one of the guys involved in this thing had died, and his widow had donated his papers. It was totally accidental.
But not accidental that I drop in after he calls the elected president of the war, the country you're waging war on, a dictator. This is from journalneo.org, Near Eastern Outlook. High comedy and the fall of Raqqa, New Eastern Outlook. Turkey sent its military into this region when the Syrian government was hopelessly besieged, sending in engineer and transport companies that removed 600 factories, including an entire auto assembly plant, from the heavily industrialized Aleppo region in the area controlled by ISIS, al-Nusra, the Free Syrian Army, the White Helmets, and a dozen other organizations. NGO charities tasked with aiding war victims grew fat, trafficking women and children into sex slavery, and ran poison gas shells and chemicals to the, quote, rebels, unquote. Endless millions in antiquities were stolen. They were traded in Israel at London and New York auctions. Groups that cry about refugees or are even featured in Academy Award-winning films take part in mass executions that have aided in the kidnapping and trafficking of tens of thousands of Syrian women and children that are not in camps anywhere and will never be seen again, unquote. Except that
stolen people and loot will be found, and we have the Eichmann case to remind us never to stop chasing them down. And when Robert Scheer is talking about this war on a dictator, he's blowing the cover on himself, because, of course, this is an elected president he's lying about. But really, let's shut up and listen to him, because the finks are the finks. And
I blew the dust off the papers, and I found the evidence of their engineering torture and everything else to keep this guy Jim in power. Unfortunately, Stanley Sheinbaum was willing to say it. The depressing thing about that, and about why we don't have more Edward Snowdens and so forth, is none of the other folks talked about it. They all stonewalled me. And they didn't come clean. And
it feels very lonely to be a whistleblower.
Well, and what's interesting about your book is there's denial. Even, you know, Peter Matheson, you know, I mean, Matheson's a very good author, a very interesting guy and everything. Mm-hmm. But at the end, he's still putting down a documentary filmmaker who he had actually told a story to. And they don't really come clean, as you point out in your book. That's why your book is so important, because the story is not well known. It's still
the story is not well known. It gets buried. It gets buried under other things. I mean, the beginning of your question and your comment, I see it now. I in my own notes, I call it super politics, where essentially there's something that's so evil and so frightening that we have to change how our democratic institutions work and whether they remain democratic. And so on the first part of your question, yeah, there was this notion that since we're on the side of the angels, we can do a lot of things that we wouldn't normally do to fight Lucifer. And what you end up with, I think anyone who uses the moral equivalency argument, you know, you can't compare American crimes to Stalinist crimes. It starts off as true, and the more you use it, the more it's a shield to make us more Stalin-like. I mean, I don't compare American history or American foreign policy to anything that Stalin did, except what I do in detail. And people who talk about Vietnam, if you count all of Southeast Asia, some of them, like Viet Nguyen, the current Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction for his book The Sympathizer, he talks about it in terms of 6 million lives lost, which is getting up into monumental numbers.
The book is How the CIA Tricked the World's Best Writers by Joel Whitney. And the more I talk about the book, the more I think, yes, they were tricked, because they, well, they, it's not a bad title, because the fact of the matter is, the fact of the matter is, these were, again, I get back to how to stand the best and the brightest. They were smart people.
Now, at some point, they were talking about the Balfour Declaration and all the engineering that got us into World War One. I think that was on this thing, but I missed it when it went by. So, anyway, I do have this queued up, so if we get a little luck from the hardware gods.
As a result of Germany's opera piece, the Rothschild War Machine goes into overdrive. Are you ready for 1917? As a result of Germany's opera piece, the Rothschild War Machine goes into overdrive in America, spreading propaganda which leads President Wilson, under the instructions of American Zionist leader and Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, reneging on his promise to the electorate and taking America into the First World War on April 6th. As per Rothschild's Zionist promise to the British to take America into the war, they decide they want something in writing from the British to prove that they will uphold their side of the bargain. The British Foreign Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, therefore drafts a letter which is commonly known as the Balfour Declaration, which is reprinted below.
And, of course, this is written to Lord Rothschild, who is the family of Rockefeller, who, and we just had David Croke at 101 after murdering Victor Jara in Chile. He's part of that conspiracy, and he escaped the justice, a fugitive from justice who escaped to his 101st year. How sad. But let's give props to the NATO target Sheikh's lawyer, the people's lawyer, Lynn Stewart. Now, I was looking for Leonard's obituary to Pelty, Peter Matheson, because it was a magnificent, reassuring piece of, truth, really. And I just want to invoke it. It's out there somewhere. for Lynn, you know, saying, you know, Peter's welcome in the big TV. And sure, Lynn is too. So just not to miss the point here, the blind sheik was the NATO target sheik. That's who NATO was putting these child-raping medieval shithooks in the mosque so that they can then wage the war. You know, when the Pentagon had a holiday and the three skyscrapers dissolved along with your IQ, and then you can murder a million Iraqis and Afghanis and everything on that bogus pretext. So for the last 15 years, 16 years, this has been going on because they lock up. Now, Mukasey is the judge. In the case of those three people, Peltier, Mumia, and Lynn Stewart, there were three people that belonged in the, you know, locked up forever. And that would be, okay, in the case of Mumia, Faulkner had an FBI camera. So the corruption of all those Philadelphia cops, you know, under the federal probe that was short-circuited by the murdering of their informants. And so lock up a bunch of those people and free Mumia, free Peltier, and then lock up all the Exxon guys. Because not only were they, you know, murdering, you know, the sending in the death squads, William and Kohler, and killing Joe Kilsroy Stuntz, and 100 perhaps or more native, traditional natives, Dick Wilson was signing over an eighth of the reservation to Exxon. Now, Exxon was buying that gas stolen by the child-raping axe murderers, the death squads that you fund in your Contra war that has never stopped ever since I came down out of the mountains, paradise, half my life ago to fight.
The entire media is like, oh, yeah, sure, they're watching us through our TV.
Oh, I'm looking for Brad. Brad, come in, Brad. Brad. Well, let me pause while this bad DJ stumbles around.
I remember when we met, surrounded by police. Was a one block in the city where protest was allowed, and they were there to keep the peace. Said, hey, my name is Brad, and I think we surely will mess up these meetings. These jokers will remember us in this city on the hill. I'd see you at the rallies, guitar on your knee, the calm inside the storm, from Prague to San Francisco, Miami to D.C. We traveled on the same roads. You were everywhere, with a smile on your face, in the redwood forest, to the streets of Tompkins Square. I'll go down to the water, and with the morning dew, I will watch the sunrise, and I'll smoke this joint for you.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Bradwell. Who filmed Comandante Aguilar and El Chino Zarate as they murdered him. How cool is that?
I'm trying to run.
I don't know. I was supposed to play the next song, which was,
high up in the air, and it leads us back again to the doors of the houses we used to live in. Bed is still warm, oh, where we once lay. Pillow still holds the shape of your face. And the places we are now, the places we've been,
Dave Rovig, Kristen Anderson, on all of Very Better from yours.
Anything?
Oh, no, just hold the mic. Oh, hi, Tristan. You remember me when we met? I think it was your first arrest. You were 17. It was Weapons Station's 50th birthday, and they weren't going to allow any protesters. Well, when was your first arrest?
My first arrest was in the chest. I put it in the chest. So I used to do the bombs and bombs around the endless world.
I see you on a bicycle, reclaiming the street, digging up the asphalt to plant a bandit garden and grow some food to eat. I got an email from Quito. He said, you've got to see this place. Everyone is rising up. Come and see the future of this lovely human race. I'll go down to the water, and with the morning dew, I will watch the sunrise, and I'll smoke this joint for you. That I saw you, it was in New York town, sitting on a rooftop talking about relationships and how to live them down. I heard you went down to Oaxaca, you joined the battle that was there. I see your picture in the paper with a bullet in your chest, in your eyes a distant stare. I'll go down to the water, and with the morning dew, I will watch the sunrise, and I'll smoke this joint for you. I'll go down to the water, and with the morning dew, I will watch the sunrise, and I'll smoke this joint for you.
Afternoon. Rap News is back online. Today we take on and analyze one of the most intractable, divisive, ongoing violent divides to happen in our time. The 60-year conflict going on betwixt Israel and Palestine. Is there a one-state, two-state, or no straight solution to this protracted fight? From Camp David to Madrid, to Harbor to Oslo, for decades back in time, all peace talks have devolved into violent rows, and roadmaps to peace have led nowhere but more war. Until now. Welcome to the first Middle East Peace Wraps. This afternoon, Rap News is proud of this tremendous chance to prove the peace-filled art of rap could chart the best roadmap to start anew. So first up, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Shalom. BB being ready this whole time to engage the peace process with war crimes. I mean raw rhymes.
Alright, well, we'd like to bring the whole story to light. Please begin by telling us Israel's side. How did this war arise?
The fact is my people have suffered awful tragedies. Centuries of persecution, diaspora. We were slaughtered, massacred. In the shore, Hitler tried to have us wiped off the map, and thus we sought a safe harbor, a place to gather us. Some told us go to Argentina, others go to Uganda. But we said go fuck yourselves. And like Exodus, we came back to our biblical homeland, Eretz Israel, which the Lord handed us. And then in 1948, we declared the birth of the Jewish state.
Your people have indeed suffered massively, unimaginably, and should have sanctuary, not just in the Middle East, but wherever they happen to be. However, isn't the Holy Land holy also to Christians and Muslims? How can you claim that only Jews own the land and exclude them?
With the Six-Day War, we fulfilled our Zionist covenant, invaded Jerusalem, the West Bank, Golan and Gaza, taking all of it,
the occupied territories.
Then on the seventh day we rested, and when all the world's nations witnessed Genesis Great Event, they condemned it?
What? It seems the UN issued Resolution 242, calling on Israel to give back those territories and withdraw troops.
Hey, hey, are you denying the legitimacy of the Jewish state?
I'm just trying to...
Anti-Semites!
Wait, what?
Everybody, these guys are Nazis!
Okay, okay, just let's relax.
Jew hater!
We've yet to ask the rival party. We now cross direct to Gaza to check the raps of a Palestinian spokesperson representing Hamas.
Salam, as you can see, we are ready to talk peace. But only within the 1967 borders will we recognize Israel and sign deals.
Oh yeah? Recognize this.
Kapow!
Hamas? Now he looks more like hummus.
What a mess.
Mr. Netanyahu, you killed him.
I guess. But it was in self-defense.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was. Yes. Check out the news coverage from the U.S. I'm Brian Washington. You're on MSNBS. Tonight's headline, peace process shattered yet again by unprovoked attacks from Arab terrorists. Israel retaliates with airstrikes in self-defense. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Palestinian suicide homes are ramming themselves into peaceful Israeli bulldozers. Israel is under threat, which is why, as shown on this map, its settlements have, steadily expanded. How can we end this injustice? To explain, we welcome John Kerry, Secretary of State.
Great to be back, Bucky. And don't you stress a bit. American taxpayers have got Israel covered till Armageddon hits. No country gets more U.S. foreign aid sent to it. $140 billion since the 70s. Plus military weaponry. No conditions or strings with it.
No conditions at all?
Well, we would prefer it better if they could kindly stop using our money to build new illegal settlements.
What did you say, you schmuck?
Baby! Oh, no, I was just telling
just
them.
Just keep sending the money, Schmickele.
Yes, sir. We'll write the check. Wait, we're getting a call from some Jewish guy in Brooklyn. He's on the line with us.
An American Jew? He's bound to be pro-Zionist. Let him speak.
Hello, MSNBS?
Yes, you're on the screen.
This is Norman Finkelstein, ringing in to state the truth in this case. Israel is a lunatic state. It's no excuse to steal Palestinian land because Jews suffered genocide at Hitler's hands.
A self-hating Jew. Everybody, this guy's an Ashkenazi.
Shut up, BB. And I also condemn American policy of funding the theft of Palestinian territory.
Okay, Funkelstein, we get the gist of all this. Now, where were we? Financing war crime.
That's a straight fact.
Well done, America.
Thank APEC. They got us by the tank sacks. We have to wave that Star of David flag.
But it's worth paying cash to have Israel's back.
That's true. They're the only nation in the Muslim backwoods that shares our American values.
Give us some examples.
We both love trampling international law.
Constantly. We're both nuclear states and democracies.
With terrorist foreign policies.
And obviously,
both America and Israel
were built by occupying territories of native peoples.
We're both settler colonies.
Awesome. Publicity time. Keep your eyes on the screen.
Professor Falk, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the main findings of your report and how unusual this report is within the United Nations?
Yes. As the head of the commission indicated, this is the first time that a comprehensive and systematic inquiry has been carried out into the allegation that Israel is responsible for maintaining an apartheid regime in relation to the Palestinian people. One of the distinctive features of the report is to treat the Palestinians as a whole. And that's quite innovative as far as the discussions of the applicability of apartheid to the Palestinian circumstances is concerned. And that means distinguishing between Palestinians that live under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, or as permanent residents in Jerusalem, or as a Palestinian minority in the State of Israel, and finally as refugees or involuntary exiles. What the report argues is that Israel has pursued a policy of fragmenting the Palestinian people in order to maintain the domination of a Jewish state over these different categories of Palestinians, and has done so in a way that is systematically discriminatory and is responsible for deep suffering over a very long period of time.
Hey, I'm Scarlett Johansson, and my real job is promoting illegal occupations. It's easy. You start by taking other people's land and water, send in Zionist settlers, push the natives out of their homes, causing bloodshed, and look, settlers dream, better for Israel and all of us.
ScarJo looks delicious, and what's more, it reminds me of our very own sponsor, Redskin Genocider. Flavor of the American nation, bloody good. Tasteful.
So, Israel is a settler colony, like Canada, America, and
Australia!
Our colonial assessor is in the area. Does Israel pass the test, Kenosha?
Kenosha? Yeah!
I'm in Jerusalem, and what's going on over there? I'm celebrating the day of Israel's birth, Yom Hetzmaut, which roughly translates to Australia Day. And wow, it's like back home, barbies, flags, beers. So in solidarity, I got the end of me knob chopped off. It's patriotic, apparently. What do Palestinians make of this day?
I don't know, eh?
Perhaps you should ask them. Okay, I'll ask the natives. Wait.
Wait, hello, can you hear me?
Hello!
Hey, how do you celebrate this wonderful day?
We natives participate with smiling faces in this party, mate. Just like your Aboriginal people on Invasion Day.
And I was cast out from the lands of my mom and my father. Now I dance as an outcast to the bombs over Gaza.
And
we sing Israel, with independence is our Nakba.
Sounds great. I'll have a party with a snack bar.
Not a snack bar, Crocodile Dundee.
Nakba.
It means a catastrophe.
Anti-Semitic.
It's far from truth. We are far from home. Zionism is far from Jews. How can I explain it to you? We lost our rights that day.
And our barbecues. No barbies. That's a tragedy. How can we help you?
BDS يعني مقاطعة. هاي الطريقة اللي بيستجم في تل أبيب زي اللي استجم في جنوب أفريقيا.
Oh yeah, let me cut to the chase. The UN report recommends boycott, divestment, sanctions, and they should put that second handle back on the police station door from the anti-apartheid struggle so we can do it all over again for Palestine.
ساعدنا نوقف جنون المستوطن ساعدنا نبني دولة فيها شوية منطق مش دولة اليهود بل دولة لليهود للمسيحية للمسلمين ليوسي لعبود لجيرياس
ولميل جيبسون
What the fuck شو خط ميل جيبسون
Well, it seems that despite the use of rap and rhyme, we failed to seal a real peace deal between Israel and Palestine. Nevertheless, I hope we've expanded our minds and are prepared to share some final thoughts before we wrap for the night. This might seem like some battle entwining other people in another time, but in fact, it mirrors back our own greatest challenge to live side by side, no matter race, flags, or which invisible man we pray to in the sky. And that is why there'll be peace nowhere until there's peace in Palestine. The war is over, if we wanted, to borrow Lenin's line. It was pressure from outside that ended the crime of apartheid that turned terrorists into winners of the peace prize. The question is, can we learn history's lessons and apply them in our time? When we analyze our direction, it's clear where the answers lie. Does any state hold the power to change the tide? Or is the one safe solution for us to unify rather than divide? Not just in the Middle East, but globally, far and wide. Good night.